This program may not represent the views of Bonneville International Corporation or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions from this broadcast are solely those of the individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Derek walks you through how to win government jobs and contracts, effectively manage your government career, and best utilize government services. Every week on Fed Access, you'll learn about interesting federal agencies, workers, and jobs. Fed Access provides you the access you need to succeed in the federal government. And now your host, Derek T. Dortch.
We're going to be talking about food and nutrition today. I have Kevin W. Concannon, and he's the Undersecretary of Food, Nutrition, and Consumer Services. We were joking that I was going to call you the Secretary, but we don't want you to lose your job, Kevin. So, but he's the Undersecretary of Food, Nutrition, and Consumer Services, and he's in charge of the Food and Nutrition Service for USDA, the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Welcome, Kevin, to Fed Access.
Well, great to be here. Great to be here.
We're going to talk about a wide variety of programs. You guys have a lot of stuff going on in terms of, you know, trying to make sure that Americans are fed, children are fed and not, you know, hungry out there and everything else. But before we get into that, what is Food and Nutrition Service? I mean, what does your agency do? Or what are you guys are about? What's the mission?
The mission we have in the Department of Agriculture are the nation's 15 first-line feeding and nutrition programs. They are the first line of defense for Americans across the country. And these programs these days, as I often say, internally as well as externally, they have never been more important than they are right now, because we've been in this extended recession going back to 2007, people losing their jobs or getting fewer hours, and we want to make sure that people have access to nutritious food. So these 15 feeding programs that we operate touch the lives directly, serve one out of four Americans over the course of the year. And some programs are larger than others, some are more targeted, but when you add them all together, again, we're serving directly one out of four Americans.
And with these 15 programs, are you the kind of agency who is kind of overseeing giving money to the state and local agencies who are kind of dealing with the direct person within that city? Or how does these 15 programs work, and what are some of the programs that people should know about?
Well, to your question, all of these programs virtually are provided at the local level, either by the state or by county, sometimes by large cities. And so USDA, the Food and Nutrition Service, we contract with agencies. And I like to think of the largest program that we operate is the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, what used to be called the Food Stamp Program. That program in the month of March this year served 40.2 million Americans, the highest number in its history. And just about half of that number are children. So it's on the plus side, it's very responsive to what's going on in the economy. And we have been working with states from one end of the country to the other, urging them, nudging them, cajoling them, doing different things to get them to provide easier access for consumers across the country, because we know a lot of people are struggling. We also operate one of our largest programs, the school lunch program. Each day in the country, 32 million American children in public and private schools have lunch at school. So that has a huge impact on children, obviously, and on learning, on kids in schools. We have a school breakfast program that serves under 12 million children, but a growing number of children have breakfast at school now. Then we have a program called the Women, Infants, and Children's Program, targeted at pregnant women and very young children up to the age of five. And what surprises people, I spoke to a group of nurses up in Chicago just recently, school nurses, there are 1,000 of them in this room, when I pointed out that 49% of all of the births in the United States, the moms are on the WIC program, and that infant in the first year of his or her life is in the WIC program. So right. That's preventive medicine, I call it, at its best.
Sure. Are all these programs very much so income-based? Is it really about that you have to, either make so much or not make so much in order to get on these programs? Or how does this work?
For example, a SNAP program, it is. They are income-related or means-tested, so-called, but the school programs, for example, actually touch all children in those schools. The USDA subsidizes all of the meals. Now, for the kids that are receiving free or reduced price meals based on family income, the USDA portion of it is the bulk of it.
Okay.
But we also subsidize meals for all of the kids in those programs. And the income eligibility, for example, for the WIC program goes a little bit higher because we want people to make sure they get access to this program, because healthy nutrition during a pregnancy is really so important. And then another line of defense we have is something called, we, of course, live in a world of acronyms. You almost need to have a language specialist with you sometimes.
Especially without a federal agency.
Any federal agency. But the TFAP, or the Emergency Food and Assistance Program, between 20 and 25% of all of the foods that are distributed across the country in church pantries or emergency shelters, or between 20 and 25% of those foods come from the USDA. And we work with about 210 or 212 food banks across the country. I've been to the Capital Area Food Bank recently as well. These food banks are not only distribution centers, they're very responsive to unmet needs. And this time of year, in the summertime, we're particularly mindful of summer feeding programs. I mentioned a few seconds ago that we serve 32 million children each day in the school lunch program. Of that number, about 19 million receive either a free or reduced price meal based on their family income. Well, we have, and Congress has authorized and supported, something called the Summer Food Service Program. And that program last summer served 2.8 million children. And one of our priorities is to increase the number of summer feeding sites, because USDA studies itself, as well as other national advocacy groups that have studied hunger in this country, summertime is the time of the year where there's the highest likelihood that children in particular will go for extended periods.
Because the kids are out of school and the parents necessarily don't know where to get, if they're poverty stricken, they don't know where to get the kind of means or resources to help feed their children.
Exactly. That some of it is location, some of it is awareness of it, some of it there are limitations. That particular summer feeding program is targeted at the areas of the country where the school population has the highest percentage of children receiving a free or reduced price lunch. Yet we know in other communities, if you happen to be living in a community where 25% of the kids are free and reduced, they're no less hungry.
Right.
So, I mean, it's one of the challenges we have of trying to live within the rules in that regard.
Have you seen the increases just across the board? I mean, urban areas, suburban areas, areas like West Virginia. I mean, has it just been across the board in terms of the increase of need for these kind of programs?
Especially so, right across the country. And the SNAP program, or the food stamp program, to me is the strongest barometer of that. 40+ million, you know, 40.2 million people in March. I'm sure when we see the April numbers, they're probably going to edge up, you know, over 40 and a half.
If we had to look at it quantitatively, maybe a couple years before the recession hit, I mean, in terms of maybe, you know, I don't know if we had the numbers exactly, but I mean, is it an increase of 10 million people? I mean, what are we seeing?
Oh, the increases have been very significant. 40.4 million people in the SNAP program. But I have seen numbers that if you go back like 3 or 4 years, the increases are up around 40%, depending on where the base year. And I know myself, I spent my career in state governments administering these programs. If someone had told me back in 2000, even the year 2000, you're going to have 40 million people depending on this, I would have said, gee, I don't think that's possible.
You're crazy, yeah.
I would have said, hey, we're probably going to stay right where we are, which at that time was somewhere around 18 million people nationally.
Okay.
So it's been, and it is, to your question, The SNAP program is very responsive both in the urban areas and in the rural areas because it's an electronic card. It's not those paper coupons right. anymore.
Has everybody moved away from the paper?
Happily. And okay. we had an event here at the Smithsonian Institution okay. last winter. And we turned over those the final old food coupons to the Smithsonian okay. where they belong.
Okay. We're talking about food and nutrition, and we're talking with Kevin W. Cancannon. He's an undersecretary of the Food, Nutrition, and Consumer Services, what they call FNS, at the Department of Agriculture. We'll be right back after this break. You're listening to Derek T. Dorch on Fed Access on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
The Federal Drive is every weekday from 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Hear interviews, news, perspective, and analysis from Tom Temin and Amy Morris. The Federal Drive team will help give you the important information you need about the federal government and how it impacts your organization or agency. Tune in 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. or go to federalnewsradio.com. The Federal Drive is sponsored by CDWG. The right technology, right away.
The Fed Cloud blog on federalnewsradio.com explores the hard issues surrounding cloud computing from the government's perspective, sharing with you the challenges, opportunities, and lessons learned from some of the top minds in the world of federal IT. Collaborate with others and help shape the discussion on cloud computing at the Fed Cloud blog on federalnewsradio.com or follow the Fed Cloud blog on Twitter, sponsored by Intel and Cisco, two technology companies leading the cloud revolution.
Video teleconferencing solutions are changing the way people communicate by breaking down walls and enabling face-to-face communication regardless of distance or environment. Tanberg, now a part of Cisco, developed Break Down the Walls to provide a window into the ways government, education, and healthcare organizations are using VTC solutions to help them operate more effectively and efficiently, and the ways video solutions can be used to address challenges facing public sector organizations today. Learn more at breakdownthewalls.com.
Deloitte invites you to join our next Debriefs program, The Money Trail, solving complex government problems using financial intelligence, on Tuesday, July 27th at 2 p.m. Debriefs webcasts feature our professionals discussing critical issues that affect your organization. For more information and to register, visit www.deloitte.com/us/debriefs. www.deloitte.com/us/DBRIEFS.
Here's Dr. Stephen Andra, Senior Health Advisor to the Secretary, VA, on the Federal Executive Forum on Health IT, sponsored by McAfee.
I think that as health IT helps transform healthcare in this country, health IT itself will also be transformed. I don't believe that the way we're looking at health IT today is going to be the way that we use it and tools that we have tomorrow.
To listen to the whole program made possible by Trezza Media Group, log on to federalnewsradio.com.
Federal IT organizations and prime contractors are experiencing a rapid rise in cybersecurity threats and compliance requirements. McAfee is the standard throughout federal, military, intelligence, and civilian enterprises worldwide. McAfee's capabilities are essential to keeping federal agencies ahead of the latest cyber threats. To learn more about how McAfee can help your organization combat cybersecurity threats, please call 1-888-VIRUS-NO or go to McAfee.com/government.
Welcome back to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. If you just joined us, we're talking about food and nutrition today, and we are talking about the Food and Nutrition Service. I have with me in the studio Kevin W. Cancannon. He's the Undersecretary of the Food and Nutrition and Consumer Services at the Department of Agriculture, and we've been having a real good conversation about what this agency does. They have over 15 different food programs that are going out to state and local agencies to make sure that we don't have hunger with children. Make sure that those who are, who need assistance can get the food and nutrition that they need in order to survive. Kevin, talk to us about a little bit more about the SNAP program, because we were talking about that, before the break. We were talking about fraudulent use. Mm-hmm. Have you seen a reduction in that?
Definitely. Since we went to these electronic benefit cards, it has both been more convenient for everybody concerned, whether it's the local stores or the consumers who enroll in the program, but also because these cards will only authorize foods. They won't authorize anything else. You can't get toothpaste or toilet paper, any non-food product. So it will be rejected. Mm-hmm. So that's where we're able to track. And then we have people who track these algorithms, these mathematical formulas, to see whether a store, a small store, that's typically where we may have an issue. I can't think of any single even supermarket we've ever had an issue with. It's typically a small store.
So and if, that runs if that, about 1%. If that supermarket 1%. Was doing something illegal, possibly, you could possibly see it through the algorithm.
Yeah, you could. That there'd be, well, one, we get calls from people. Okay. So we do take calls. If people say, hey, I saw something funny, we investigate that. The states or the counties take calls. We take information that way. But we also do that tracking, that algorithm we track, so that if we saw something that didn't look right to us, we would look more closely at it. And now, some of those improper payments that I've referred to are allowing somebody to have a non-food item, for example. So it's wrong from the program's point of view, but it's not like they're trying to misappropriate dollars or do something. The fraud rate runs about 1%, which is very low for a large entitlement program. And we were very pleased with this number of 4.3% overpayment and underpayment. And we audit that. We do samples in the states, and then we figure, well, did this person get less than he or she should have received or more? So that's how we track that. And that is the lowest in the history of the program.
Okay.
And we think that's quite an achievement, given the fact that many cities, counties, states have been in tough times in terms of their staffing revenue situations at the very same time when more people are coming in the front door seeking help. Well, that's not a miracle that it happened that way. It can be explained by the fact the USDA works very closely with states, encouraging them. As I often say, I said it in Chicago recently at a meeting, fortunately, the patent laws that apply to government are very weak ones, so we can share information where one government, if it works. We want what works. We go around the country and say, in fact, we even have a budget program in USDA where we can take a state and say, look, why don't you go out to Oregon? They're doing this great. Or we'll bring the Oregon manager who manages the very kind of program you're responsible for here to your state to show how this can be done. And I think that the states have been very responsive in that regard. We have a category called categorical eligibility, which in everyday language simply means we've simplified the application, simplify the work for the worker, but people still have to meet the income guidelines at the end of the day. And we're now up to about 38 states that have adopted that, and we are the Gulf states. Three of those Gulf states have just recently decided to do that. Okay. Well, that will help at this time as well.
And I see on your website that you guys have a deep water oil spill response. I mean, what is your service? You know, I mean, everybody's thinking about how Coast Guard and everybody else, EPA, is, you know, responding. But you guys are also doing some stuff down there.
Yes, we are. We're right from the first, starting with Louisiana, where when this deep water spill started, our regional office went to the state, drove up to the state, or flew up from Dallas and said, how can we help you, both simplifying, and in Louisiana's case, they adopted this simplified eligibility, so that our goal in all of that is, in one example of it, is if a person has some modest assets, but they don't have any income right now, and they don't have unemployment, or they don't have Social Security, the state can make them eligible for the SNAP program. And Louisiana, Alabama, Mississippi, and most recently Florida has adopted that. So all four of those states, Texas has not yet, but the impact to date has been coming eastward of that spill.
Are you making the process easier? So if a person comes in, they say, listen, you know, I didn't at one point in time need this, but I just lost my job because I can't work on the oil rig anymore. Are you making it almost kind of a fast track process in order for these people to be able to get assistance really quick?
Yes. There are two aspects to the SNAP program. If you come in and say, hey, my refrigerator is empty, or I have small kids and it's just about empty, there's a federal requirement that you have that benefit within 5 days. And in many states, what they will do, they will give you the card to go out the door. It won't be loaded electronically until they verify the information you've sent in. But the underlying reason to approach it that way is to get help quickly to people. And in the case of the Gulf states, that's exactly why we have been promoting. I know our secretary, Secretary Vilsack, wrote to the governors. I wrote to the commissioners of the Health and Human Service agencies and urged them to consider categorical eligibility, because both of these states, even apart from the effects of deep water, had a number of poor people who are eligible sure. for these programs that sometimes, especially older people or people who may, English may not be their first language.
Sure.
This is intimidating when you ask to put together all these financial documents. So we wanted to make it respectful, but also we have worked with organizations in those states to do outreach. For example, I'm mindful of a Vietnamese community where a lot of people work in the fishing industry. They've been particularly adversely affected by this. Well, we want to make sure that there's outreach, culturally appropriate outreach to that community, so that they can be made aware that you can receive this help. And on your question, as I've traveled around the country, even outside of the Gulf, there is not a state office that I've been to, or a county office, or an emergency food center that hasn't pointed out to me they're seeing people in this economy who themselves never envisioned that they would be coming in to seek help. They may have been the volunteers or the contributors sure. on the private side in the past, but so many people, their personal financial circumstances have changed. So that's why we're very interested in wanting to engage them so that they know this benefit is there for them.
Do you find that many people know about it? I mean, are you finding that you need to advertise it more to kind of say, we've got these programs out here, we've got these summer programs, we can help you? Or does most of the country know that you're here and sometimes maybe apprehensive to get it? I mean, what are you seeing?
I would say that there's still large groups. There are three groups in particular that awareness of their eligibility for the program is probably the first barrier. And those folks are elderly people, older folks, people of Hispanic background, and recently unemployed or underemployed. They may say, hey, I have some income, so I guess I'm not eligible. Well, they may be eligible because after we look at their cost of housing and their cost of driving to work or whatever it might be, especially people on limited hours, they may be eligible for the program. And by the way,
so you could possibly be getting unemployment, so to say, and then, you know, still find yourself eligible for this program. I mean, are the offices
absolutely.
Kind of talking to each other, like the unemployment office saying, hey, listen, in addition to you getting this, why don't you get, you know, SNAP?
It starts right at the top of the federal government. It starts right at the White House. I think, the president has made it clear to the various cabinet secretaries of his expectation of working across lines. And I know this from, again, my state experience, that most people's human needs don't fall into a neat little category
sure.
of one particular program. You really need to build the kind of the safety net. And I know our secretary and Secretary Sebelius over in HHS, the labor secretary, the housing secretary, and the education secretary, Duncan, they've all worked on a number of joint ventures, and they've helped us and we've helped them. So these days, for example, we've sent letters have been sent out by those secretaries to the state agencies, advising them when somebody has either lost their job or applying for unemployment, make sure you let them know that they might be eligible
okay.
for health insurance or for the SNAP program
right.
or their kids in the school-based program. That's an area that we promote as well.
Right.
During the school year, as I often say, who among us doesn't know somebody whose circumstances didn't change in the last 6 months or last
That's
year?
Right.
And yet, in the past, schools would have decided at the beginning of the school year who gets a free or reduced price lunch. So we have been urging schools update that information frequently, and they can do it electronically. It doesn't require you to go into the school and say, or me to go in and say, I just, you know, my circumstances have changed. If they match those data sets, those information at a state level, for example, if a child is in a family that is receiving either SNAP or the TANF program, the Temporary Needy Family Cash Program, they are automatically eligible for a free meal.
Okay.
And I think that's particularly important in both cities as well as small towns. Let's not add one more burden on those parents who are already struggling to say, well, you forgot to fill in the form back in October or whatever it might be. So we promote something called this direct certification is that term. And the Congress is considering, you know, the reauthorization of the child nutrition bill that covers all these children's feeding programs. And one of the elements in it, there are a number of strong elements that the president has proposed to ease access for families who need these helps.
We're talking about food and nutrition today, and we're talking to Kevin W. Kankanen. He's the Undersecretary of Food, Nutrition, and Consumer Services at the Department of Agriculture. We'll be right back after this break. You're listening to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Here's Joseph Grace, President and CEO of Grace Associates, on the Cyber Warfare Prevention Securing Your Software and Applications panel, sponsored by Fortify Software.
There's going to be interagencies that are working together, whether you have FEMA working with medical, working with National Guard. As these things come online and they start communicating in a cloud environment, there has to be some kind of tool that takes a look at the people coming in. Are they safe? Are they secure? Can we actually let them look at our information? Can we share the information back? There's an operational demand for that.
To listen to the program made possible by Fortify Software in its entirety, log on to federalnewsradio.com.
On May 20th of 2010, Vivek Kundra released the State of Public Cloud Computing Report. It states that as we move to the cloud computing environment, we must ensure standards are in place that protect the privacy of our citizens and safeguard our national security interests. Fortify Software can help you unlock the benefits of the cloud while allowing you to feel safe about the security of your applications. Find the vulnerabilities inside your software. Fix them quickly and cost-effectively. Fortify your applications with security. Visit fortify.com.
This federal government update is brought to you by the U.S. General Services Administration.
A change in the travel reimbursement structure for the Air Force could mean more money in the pockets of some airmen and civilians. Under the new system, the cost of a trip will be estimated before an employee leaves. If more than that is spent, the employee must pay the difference, spend less, and the employee gets to keep the change. The Federal Times says the new system is currently in place at 5 installations across the world. The Air Force hopes to have all 480,000 cardholders under the system by the fall.
Wherever your mission takes you, FedRooms delivers the best government hotel rates available. FedRooms hotels are fire safe, FEMA certified, and continually audited to ensure rates are at or below per diem, so there are no unadvertised fees or hidden costs. Always ask for the FedRooms rate or visit gsa.gov/fedrooms/options. That's gsa.gov/fedrooms/options. GSA, your everything source for lodging needs from FedRooms.
Welcome back to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. If you just joined us, we've been having a real good conversation about food and nutrition today. And we've been talking about all the different programs that the federal government is doing in order to help state and local agencies and help our citizens in order to get food that they need. If they're a person who's lost their job, if they're the elderly or underemployed or whatever the case is, there are programs out there to help people get what they need in order to feed themselves, feed their children, and everything else. I have with me Kevin W. Kankanen. He's an Undersecretary of Food, Nutrition, and Consumer Services at the Department of Agriculture, what they call FNS, the Food and Nutrition Service. Kevin, we were talking about kind of SNAP and all the other kind of programs, what you guys are doing in the Gulf. We mentioned about Congress. You mentioned about Congress and appropriation dollars. Are you guys, you know, kind of lobbying Congress to say, listen, you know, we need more dollars for the children program. We need more dollars for SNAP, for WIC, and everything else?
The president's budget starts right at the White House. You know, the president made a commitment even before he was elected to end childhood hunger by 2015. Okay. And I believe, and I think most informed people believe, we can actually do that in this country. But if we are to succeed in that regard, we have to optimize. We have to make sure that these 15 federal feeding programs are operating at their highest form. And this every 5 years, federal appropriations bills come up for what's called reauthorization. It gives the Congress an opportunity to make adjustments, changes, corrections, and this is the year for child nutrition. Well, the programs that are affected by that child nutrition reauthorization are the school lunch, the school breakfast program, the child and adult care feeding program. This is the feeding program for children who go to child care. About 11 million children each day in the U.S. go to child care.
Okay.
And so it's very important that child and adult care feeding program is a major part of that. The WIC program, I mentioned that earlier, for pregnant women and their young children. And those programs are up for reauthorization this year. We also have an opportunity for the summer feeding program right now. That's okay. Another program that is affected by it. And the president has proposed an additional $1 billion per year, $1 billion for each of 10 years, $10 billion over 10 years. And the largest bulk of that would go into improving the meal quality in schools.
Okay. We're talking about better food, better nutrition type food, making it, because sometimes everybody gets concerned about what's in the meal.
Exactly. And we hired the Institute of Medicine of the National Academy of Sciences, a group of physicians and professional nutritionists and others, to make recommendations to us to improve the meal quality based on the dietary guidelines for all Americans. They gave us those recommendations back in October, actually, of last year, and staff at FNS are in the process right now of writing the regulations to reflect those improved meals. And what are they? It's more fruits, more vegetables, less fats, less sodium.
Less sugar.
We think it's very achievable, but schools have the same experience we have in our own private lives. Oftentimes, healthier foods cost a little more.
You know, why is that the case, though? I don't know, maybe you can speak to that, but why do healthier foods in terms of the fruit and vegetables seem to, you know, cost more than the potato chips or the sweets or candies when we're kind of picking it off of, off of nature?
Mm-hmm. That's a very good question. I think part of it is, you know, they particularly for many of the fruits and vegetables are seasonal in the northeast climates or in the northern climates of the country. So they may come from another region of the country. But one of our initiatives is promoting more regionally grown foods as well, farm to school or know your food, know your farmer.
And so you're thinking about having kind of a local farmer now kind of putting stuff directly into the actual school systems.
And we are encouraging that. We actually have a team from FNS right now that is studying 15 selected school systems across the country, both to say that are doing this right now, that, by the way, that are purchasing locally. And we're learning from them, okay, this is what the school needs, because if you're the school dietitian, you need to make sure that those fruits or those vegetables are going to be there on time come October 1 or whatever the date might be. And local farmers, not the big, huge agricultural combines, but rather the smaller farms, may have less experience that way. So
Sure. We
are also interviewing farmers that are providing that to the schools, the purpose of which is for us to be able to provide technical assistance and support
Okay. So
that more people can procure those goods locally. We have an initiative as well and a budget request that's pending before Congress to equip all of the farmers markets across the country with wireless capacity so that people can use those electronic benefit cards, the SNAP cards. And again, our rationale for that is to promote access to healthier foods, but we also know it will help the local economy, and we think that's a good thing.
With the farmers markets, and even with kind of this program right there, I mean, do you find that it's really a matter of that these local farmers, as you mentioned, bringing technical assistance, they just don't necessarily have the know-how in terms of maybe operating their business at that level or getting these contracts with a state agency or something like that? That's where you guys are kind of coming in and saying, this is how you go through the process to now become a vendor for the government, and these are the tools you need.
Right. And we believe that one of the effects of that will be to help some of those very small farms now increase the size of their production so that the per unit costs are lower. I mean, scale has something to do with cost at the end of the day, too. And so we believe that to the extent that we can encourage schools to be local purchasers, that same farmer who this time of year may be at the farmer's market, if that farm knows they're going to be able to sell squash or apples or what have you through the fall to the school department, that's a good thing for everybody concerned, and you don't have to have that product coming across the country on the interstate system, you know, for 3,000 miles.
Are we looking at hopefully maybe one day, and maybe this is the vision, and tell me if it is, are we looking at a day where we don't have as much prepackaged food in the school systems, processed food in the school systems, and it's kind of coming in, just on time, and it's fresh and everything? I mean, is that what we want to get
to? That, and you know what? When you mention that, we have a category right now called Healthier U.S. Schools Challenge. There are 720 of them. These are the best schools in the country in terms of both activity for kids, because that's one of the factors in being overweight. Kids don't get enough physical activity, activity and healthy foods. And we are, that's the vision to have, there are 101,000 schools, public and private, that serve lunch each day through the FNS programs. We have 700 plus that are models right now. Our goal is to get up to 3,000. Michelle Obama, the first lady, has said, how about 3,000 within 2 years? So we're marching to that right now. But the idea behind that, again, is if kids learn to eat healthier at school, when they're walking through the supermarket with their parents on the weekend, they'll reach up for, you know, the orange or the fruit or the banana, not just those processed foods that, that you referenced. As Americans, you know, the newspaper here a couple of weeks ago did a series on how much processed foods Americans eat. We eat more processed foods than any other country in the world. And those foods tend to be calorie dense, and you know, they may have a number of elements,
sodiums and all kind of things that, well,
and
that hurts
to
you.
The extent we can get people back to the basics, we think there's winners all around in that regard.
I'm talking to Kevin W. Kincannon. He's an Undersecretary of Food, Nutrition, and Consumer Services. You listen to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
How do you keep your infrastructure safe without limiting your people and productivity? CA Technologies let you control every use of every IT asset by everyone who accesses your systems. Can you say yes to new capabilities? Can you enforce defense in detail, not just defense in depth? Can you empower your people while protecting your systems? With CA Technologies, you can. To learn how, visit ca.com/security.
Attention AFGE members, government, and military employees looking for a hassle-free way to buy a new computer, electronics, or home appliances. Purchasing Power allows you to get items such as Dell laptops, HP desktops, and Kenmore appliances through easy payroll deduction. Purchase any laptop from July 15th through August 15th and receive a free custom skin. Get started today. Log on to shoppurchasingpower.com. That's shoppurchasingpower.com.
AFGE members are eligible for a 6% members only discount.
Well, you know, Facebook has been having somewhat of a problem because they're just sharing your data with everybody. Deactivation is not the same as deletion.
The information is still out there.
And what they try to do is they try to urge you to deactivate, and they try to keep you away from that nasty deletion page. You see, deactivation simply turns off your account but does not remove the data. The idea behind deactivation is that someday you'll be back.
Stratford University's Tech Talk Radio, Saturday mornings from 9 to 10 on Federal News Radio, 1500.
How is the U.S. Navy evolving its information capabilities? What is the Naval Information Dominance Strategy? How is the U.S. Navy introducing bold, game-changing strategies and concepts for the next generation? Listen next week as these questions and more will be explored with Vice Admiral Jack Dorsett, Deputy Chief of Naval Operations for Information Dominance and Director of Naval Intelligence. Join host Michael Keegan next week on the Business of Government Hour.
My name is Deborah Mark. I've been a truck driver for 11 years. I'm good at what I do, and I love it. I also have high blood pressure. I didn't take it seriously, and it got me into trouble.
One in three American adults has high blood pressure. It is a leading cause of heart attack, stroke, and kidney failure.
3 years ago, I was driving in Toledo, Ohio, and I became very sick. So I pulled over on a ramp. My kidneys had shut down. I wound up in the hospital. I could have died. So now I take it very seriously.
High blood pressure is one of our most serious health threats. That's why Novartis is developing new treatments and providing programs that help doctors and patients manage high blood pressure.
I'm doing all the right things now. I eat better. I take my medication every day. I exercise. And this is my second chance.
Novartis. Think what's possible.
The Pentagon and Beyond. Brought to you by Airink.
The Afghan Taliban leadership is facing more pressure from the U.S. The Treasury Department has decided to freeze the militants' assets, ban travel, and trigger an arms embargo. The United Nations did the same thing earlier in the week after General David Petraeus, the top U.S. military commander in the region, suggested it. The U.S. and U.N. sanctions taken together prohibit any financial transaction of the terror leaders in any U.N. member country. I'm J.J. Green.
Can you imagine buying a television or vehicle today that you'll still be using in 40 years?
Probably not. When the military purchase an airplane, they know it has to last at least that long or longer, and the parts for the airplane may already be obsolete. That's where Airink comes in. Airink helps the DoD plan ahead for parts obsolescence. This planning saves money and lessens the risk of counterfeit parts being used if the original supplier no longer exists. For more information and career opportunities, log on to ARINC.com.
Welcome back to Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. If you just joined us, we've been having a really, really good conversation. If you missed part of it, you need to go back and listen to it. But we've been talking about food and nutrition today. And I have with me Kevin W. Kankanen. He's an Undersecretary of Food, Nutrition, and Consumer Services and has a long record of working with these programs on state and local areas and now is doing it at the federal level. We've been talking about what food and nutrition service does and all the different programs, even the food chart that your agency does. Kevin, talk to us a little bit more about, you know, you mentioned about 720 schools. I think this is important about these programs are benchmark programs who are, you know, doing more fitness, more activity, and also using more kind of food and nutrition as a benchmark of healthier foods. Where can people find that information?
We have some 800 numbers that we can provide, which I will provide, but also people can contact the local, the State Department of Education, or in the this case, the District Department of Education. That's the link we have at the local level across the country for those healthier U.S. schools in four states, but none of the states in this immediate area. It's the Department of Agriculture, but usually it's the State Department of Education has a person responsible for nutrition programs. And for example, I've been out to some schools in Maryland where the state agency person has come along and they are promoting it as well. But we want, and by the way, the Child Nutrition Reauthorization Bill that is before Congress would both expand the number of those healthier U.S. schools, again, activity as well as healthy eating. And, you know, I've been to a number of those schools in poor areas as well as in urban areas, poor rural areas. And what I find is that the focus on nutrition isn't limited to the 30 minutes at noontime. The PE, the phys ed program has effort, you know, a focus on have you eaten the proper foods, the food groups. The math program uses, you know, ounces and how many calories and so on to apply into math. And then I even saw one of the art programs, one of the schools had, you know, pottery and so on made to look like different fruits and vegetables. So it's a way to really get kids thinking about it. And some of the neatest examples I've seen are schools that develop just a single, like a garden that may be 1 acre.
Sure.
And that garden isn't enough to, obviously, to provide all the school to the food. But what it does, it brings the kids out, especially elementary kids, and they say, this is where food comes from. Because we know food comes from farms, but for a lot of little kids growing up, they think food comes from the Safeway.
Yeah.
It comes from, you know, it comes
especially
from...
Especially if you're in an urban area, you've never seen that.
It comes in the front door. So it seems to have had a really almost a magical effect on kids when they get a chance to see stuff growing, and then they'll try it.
Right.
You know, I was at a school where kids were saying, this okra is good. That's okra?
If you've done that, then you have succeeded in some stuff.
Yeah, no, these are creative, you know, school nutrition people. So to your question on that, if people, one, I would urge them to contact the state education agency.
And these are kind of called U.S. Healthier Schools. I mean, that's what they should be asking
healthier
for.
Healthier U.S. School Challenges.
Okay.
Any school can become one of those. In the past, they were limited to elementary schools, but again, the First Lady said, let's do it for middle schools and high schools.
Do they get a designation from you?
They do. Okay. They have to meet certain criteria, and one of the most important criteria that they have to meet is there can be no competitive foods, and by that is meant they can have a line for the poor kids to get the school lunch, and then a different line over here where you can pay to have pizzas or so-called a la carte foods.
Right.
That everybody has to have the same meal.
Okay.
And in the schools that have done that, they still have a vending machine, but the difference is the vending machine just has healthy foods in
it.
And kids will actually eat healthy
foods
if that's they're nudged in that direction. And that's what everybody's eating. Right. There's no competitive foods.
There was a big push at one time where schools were putting in Coca-Cola machines and candy machines and kind of using that extra money off of those vending machines to do, whether it be special programs. Are we moving away, kind of backing off from that now and kind of saying, you know, no more Coca-Cola machines? And
well, they can have a Coke machine, but it has to have, like, just fruit juice or water in it. You can't have the sugary drinks.
Stuff.
And because a number of schools said, gee, we need those machines for fundraising for our clubs or sports events or what. And we said, well, there are ways to raise money still, but don't do it through promoting, you know, unhealthy foods that kids don't need.
Have the major companies kind of gotten on board with you with this? I mean, are you working with the major kind of distributors of these products, and they say, hey, listen, we go along with this as well?
They actually have. They have signed on with the First Lady with her Let's Move campaign. And at a recent meeting, again, when I was up in Chicago, we had people there from Frito-Lay who were promoting, again, healthier food options for kids. So it's going to be a gradual shift, I think, sure, in the case of those manufacturers. But I think they get it that all of a sudden there's great concern in this country about, you know, obesity and overweight is, one of our highest healthcare challenges. So we need to do something about that. So
I know you got some websites and numbers, because, I mean, our time will go quickly if we don't mention them now. I want you to make sure you get these out to people.
Well, you know, if people are interested in those healthier U.S. schools, let's say a parent or a teacher, anybody might be interested for their local school, we have a website. It's www.fns.usda.gov. www.fns.usda.gov. And we have a toolkit, an online toolkit, where you can learn about that and bring it into your school. I mean, the schools that have been able to do this, it isn't any one person. They kind of got the principal on board. And you know what's interesting? In all schools I've gone to, teachers have said, gee, especially classroom, breakfast in the classroom, they thought, gee, this will be another burden on me. They become such fierce advocates for it because they said the kids are able to concentrate better. They're not leaving in the middle of the morning to go see the school nurse because they have a stomach ache, because they actually have had something to eat, healthy to eat. So it has a lot of benefits, even in the learning process itself. And for the SNAP program that we talked about earlier, again, people whose circumstances may have changed, we have an 800 number. It's 1-800-221-5689. That's a toll-free number.
Okay.
And they can get information on SNAP or the foods, what used to be called food stamp program in their state. And finally, if they're uncertain about other aspects of food and nutrition or where they might get help, there is the National Hunger Clearinghouse toll-free number, and that's 1-866-348-6479. And if it helps people to remember, it's 1-866-3 and the letters hungry.
Okay. Do you see the possibility of ending hunger totally in our nation?
We can be close to that. Our goal is to end hunger for children by 2015. There's no question in my mind that we have the capacity to grow food in this. I lived in Iowa, and I used to jokingly say, if you stood still there for a while, corn would start growing around you.
Yeah, right.
But I mean, we have a tremendous capacity to grow food. And so it's not a matter of do we have it. It's a matter of do we have the will to make sure and the priority that no person should go hungry in this country. And I think it's not a political issue, it's a moral issue that we really ought to live up to.
Does that will come from everybody? I mean, does it come from the corporation? Does it come from, you know, our local political leaders? Does it come from, I mean, does it have to be all of us kind of say that this will?
It does. No one sector. The government can't do it alone. The government has a responsibility with these 15 feeding programs. Again, I've been at some of these summer feeding sites recently because that's our priority right now at this time of year. And the best ones are ones that engage the local agencies, the school board, the Boys and Girls Club, the food banks. I've seen a variety of partnerships. And I think the more people are willing to participate, not necessarily have to say, this has to just have my brand on it alone, That's the way we're going to solve these things. And the private sector has a major responsibility as well, both to make sure that we're providing healthy alternatives, healthy opportunities for people, not foods that are going to exacerbate some of their issues.
And that are not so costly. I mean, healthier foods that don't cost your arm and a leg.
Affordability, I often say, you know, poor people can add just like the rest of us, so it has to be affordable. And oftentimes, those foods that they buy are, they buy the most calories they can for the limited amount of money. So I can understand their rationale that way, but we need to make healthy foods affordable consistently for people. And that's, again, where that child nutrition reauthorization we're talking about, I think we can get a whole generation of children off on the right start. We changed our WIC food package last October based on recommendations from a medical, you know, the Institute of Medicine. And I've gotten nothing but positive feedback on that from parents, from physicians, from nurse practitioners and others who are dealing with pregnant women. And we know if we get you started in the right way, I mean, those benefits extend into teenage years for kids. So, these are all, I put them all, or many of them, in the category of preventive health.
Undersecretary of Food, Nutrition, and Consumer Services, Kevin W. Concannon, thank you so much for coming on Fed Access.
You've been listening to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear it in its entirety on our website, federalnewsradio.com. Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch, Friday afternoons at noon, only on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, WFED, your source for federal news now.